Welcome to our public launch of the report of news agencies in Europe. The title of this panel tonight is Who Owns the News? My name is Sarah Benet Weiser. I'm the head of the department in media and communication, and I'm chairing this panel. We have a really diverse and interesting group of people to speak tonight, and what we're going to do is offer everyone a couple of minutes to kind of talk about what their particular interest or their point of entry is into issues of news ownership and issues of news agencies and the future of news agencies, and then we'll have the panelists kind of discuss together some of the points we talk about, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. I want to just kind of introduce this public launch. This has been a day of different presentations with this group for the News Agencies in Europe kind of project. But tonight we're really talking about how we can strengthen links between academic research, news industries, practitioners, professors, and think about the different collaborations and what we can learn from each other and how we can strengthen the kind of study of news as well as the future of news agencies. I come here to the UK from the US about 6 months ago, so I have, who knows if it's a unique relationship with the news, especially over the past 2 years when so many of news reports have been labeled as fake or disinformation or wrong, including news agencies. And so it's kind of when I was thinking about this panel, thinking about how it is that we, you know, move beyond that conversation about things like misinformation. And here at the LSE, we have a think tank, Polis, Professor Charlie Beckett, who's here, is the director of that. We also commissioned the LSE Truth, Trust, and Technology Commission, which brought together policy, academic research, and ways to think about news and the future of news. And Robin Mansell was also part of that commission, who's also here tonight. So really what we want to do this evening is think about what are some of the different things that we need to think about in terms of the future of the news. So we're going to be talking about things like audiences. How do people consume the news? How should they consume the news? How do we regain trust? Or do we even try to do that? Differences in innovation and creativity in the news. Some news agencies have a lot more, many more resources and ability to be creative and innovative with the kinds of stories they can produce, with the kinds of reporting they can do. Others have far fewer resources and can't, in fact, produce the same kind of news. We're going to be talking about copyright and ownership in the question, who owns the news? What does that mean when you own information? What is the strategy behind there? How are we equipped to deal with these kinds of things? So the goal here is to, again, strengthen the collaborations between academics and news agencies and practitioners, and to, you know, think about providing new concepts and new business models for national news agencies and their attempts to kind of maintain their position in a very precarious time, in a time where things seem very unstable. We also would like to engage policymakers in future discussions about the future of news agencies and what policy has to do with it. So with that, I'm going to introduce our speakers, and then they will give just a few minutes, like I said, and we're hoping to have a really engaged, participatory conversation tonight about these issues. So immediately to my left, we have Professor Tahri Rentanen, who is a professor of media and communications here at LSE. Next to her, we have Professor Henrik Ornebring, who is a professor of media and communication at Karlstad University. Then we have Ms. Christine Bulhagier. Who's the regional director of Europe at AFP. And then we have Mr. Madhav Chenappa, the director of strategic relations, news, and publishers at Google. So without further ado, Tahri is up first. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce our research report on the future of European news agencies on behalf of our research team. And I am not going to read a presentation, or I'm not going to summarize the report. I will provide some highlights from the report, and then perhaps provide a kind of snapshot of this evening's topic, who owns the news, because it's not only the news agencies that own the news, and this is of course a debate we are going to have. But this is the cover of the report. 500 copies were printed, and they are available, and it is very much collaborative research. So this is a project that was done from the beginning with the European Alliance of News Agencies. And the European Alliance of News Agencies consists of 32 national news agencies in Europe. And we had a research team of 12 researchers from 7 different countries. And we had funding from 3 countries. And I think this project shows, among other things, LSE's commitment to Europe. Whatever the UK government says, we are part of Europe. We do research about Europe with our European colleagues, and I'm very proud of this. So, we have a main report, and we have 4 case studies, and we have been discussing the case studies all afternoon. And I will shortly introduce them. But first I introduce this map. And many of you may not have seen it. It's a map of national news agencies in Europe. And you can see that almost every country has a news agency. And many of these news agencies, they have kind of funny names, if I may say so. Some of them have still the word telegraph in them. Many of them have the name of their customers, like the press, in them. But they are the most established news organizations in Europe, most of them already founded in the 19th and early 20th century. But very few actually know about them, if we are talking about audiences or consumers or citizens. You may have heard the name SDT, I'm being very patriotic here, or PAP, but you don't actually know what they do. And this is one of the dilemmas. So because news agencies have traditionally been wholesalers of news, they have sold news to the media. So we haven't so far realized what an important role they may play when we talk about how to inform citizens in different countries in Europe. So our funding, I already informed you that we have funding coming from different countries, and if any, I think there are several of our funders here, so thank you very much for doing that. And here are the 4 case studies we have been discussing this afternoon, and they all kind of tackle certain aspects of news agency operations, and this was exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to have a project that was as inclusive as possible. We didn't only want to concentrate on the biggest and on the most successful news agencies, we wanted to do research on different types of news agencies. And I think one of the outcomes, which may be self-evident, is that, you know, there is not only one future for all news agencies in Europe, but several. So here are our research questions, and I just kind of show them to you briefly. So our main question was how and to what extent does the rapidly changing contemporary news ecosystem challenge the viability of the concept of a national news agency in Europe? So the question was, what will happen to news agencies in the future? And we tackled the question in several ways. We talked, we asked questions about ownership, we asked a question about the value of general news service, and we asked a question about news agency clients. And this is what we found out. Research question one. Traditionally, news agencies were divided into private, cooperative, and state. What we found out is that ownership of news agencies are being transformed and are becoming much more hybrid. And there were two kind of long-term changes in terms of ownership. The amalgamation of cooperative news agencies with other categories of ownership, and the emergence of public ownership. So, in a way, in the past, news agencies, there was this category of cooperative agency, but that we saw it there, but it was kind of hidden already. So, in a way, most of the research so far has concentrated on private and cooperative news agencies. But actually, what we found out in our study is that a significant number of news agencies in Europe are state-owned agencies. And actually, the relationship between agencies and the governments may have become stronger rather than weaker. And this is something I think we need to discuss later. So this is the reality. We have been talking so much about private and cooperative agency, but in reality, the state is playing a more significant role in several countries. Then we asked the question about how do news agencies assess the value of their general news service. And as you know, in the past, this general news service played a key role in all news agency operations. Actually, it would be very difficult, maybe we'll see it in the future, but at the moment, to define the news agency without news. But, unfortunately, our findings reveal that there is this decreasing profitability of general news service. So customers are less and less dependent on news agencies, since news is available from other sources at a lower price. News agencies increasingly, especially those who are privately owned, find themselves competing with their own owners and clients in general news services. And that the market is not necessarily any more purely national, but national news agencies increasingly sell their service to linguistic and culturally proximate markets outside their countries of location. So the concept of national news agency is changing. And news agencies, to be able to survive in several countries, they have to find other sources of revenue in order to compensate for the losses they face in providing news service. And of course, as it was already pointed out by Sarah, there are big differences between news agencies in terms of size. So, and then finally, how do national news agencies perceive their clients? I think the stereotypical picture is that they don't care much about their clients, but this was not true. Actually, almost all news agencies did do analyses on their clients and did listen to their clients and were very attentive to their needs. But of course, the problem for news agencies is that they are very heavily dependent on their old clients, traditional media, and including newspapers and broadcasting companies. And we were shown this data this afternoon, how newspapers are facing a really problematic time and have been doing so for a long time. So if news agency clients are in trouble, then news agencies themselves are in trouble. And news agencies have been really trying to diversify their strategies, and many of them have been very successful, but it has been very difficult to significantly diversify where their income comes from. So they have, and they continue to do so, they have searched for new clients, and they have diversified their operations, but there is a limit to that, and we can talk about it later. So why do news agencies matter? So can we just, if they, some of them are in trouble, can we just kind of forget them and have something else instead? I think what we argue is that, first, that news does not only have an economic value, but also a societal value. And that's when national news agencies play a really big role. And if there is no money, if it is not profitable to provide general news service, and if there is no national news agency, who does it then? You know, what are the organizations that will fulfill this function? We also argue that national news agencies are frequently either taken for granted, or the role they play in the news ecosystem is structurally concealed because they don't directly reach the audience in most cases. So I think the lack of awareness at various levels is a key problem. And this is something national news agencies themselves should do. They should say it loud and explain what they are doing. And they should inform politicians, policymakers, and the public about their importance. Because we believe that they play a really important role, and it's a public role, to provide trustworthy news to the media that in turn serves the public. So when we talk about news agencies becoming public, we talk about several things. We talk about public awareness and public support. We are not only talking about public money, we are talking about other things. We are talking about the importance of news agencies, we think is something that hasn't been kind of said loudly and clearly. And since I am an academic, to study national news agencies in Europe is crucial if we want to strengthen the relationship between news, democracy, and society. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I'll just sit here if you don't mind. Saves me the trouble of getting up. So I'm just going to make a couple points. As Terry said, for many of you, this is like the beginning of a wonderful public talk. For some of us, this is like the end of the day, because we've had these knowledge exchange sessions between the academics, the authors of the reports, and representatives of many national news agencies. I've studied news and journalism for about 2 decades, and I've been to many events that have the title like "Who Owns the News?", "The Future of News?", "The What's Going to Happen with the News?", "Oh my God, news are going to die," those kind of things. And there was one thing that was different today, because in almost all of the other events that I've been to of this type, it's the audience, the end user, takes center stage. Like, how do people consume the news today? We're sharing it on social media and so on and so forth. Now, granted, today, and in the report also, there's talk about the audience, but it doesn't take center stage because, as has been pointed out, news agencies are wholesalers. They don't sort of communicate that much directly to the end user. That's not to say that they don't care about them. I know we also heard that you are also studying the audience and trying to figure out what the end user wants. But my point here is one of organizational culture. Like, we know that a company or any organization is sort of it's path dependent. The way it sort of ends up being has to do with the sort of idea that founded it, or what have you seen as your sort of core business or your core activity. And the proposal that I would like to make, or invite reflection on perhaps, is that if you are a type of organization that has sort of built your core proposition on being like B2B, business to business, then how can you cope with the fact that news is increasingly being understood and defined as a B2C, as a business to customer good? So that was something that struck me today, and something that I think we could maybe reflect on. Because some of the things that come up in the report and come up in the discussion, when news agencies want to formulate what is their value proposition, what's their unique selling point? Well, we provide sort of verified quality news, yeah, which I think makes sense. It's a very compelling argument. There are a few organizations that have a longer track record of doing precisely that. But that argument, like, why is that a unique selling point? Well, it's because something that audiences need, or what audiences deserve to have this, these verified high quality news. So you're essentially sort of, if, as is suggested in the report, like if there should be like perhaps a public subsidy or something, then you're also motivating that with the fact that like the audience, the public needs this, yeah? So you're the news agencies are justifying their services with reference to the audience, but they don't sell it directly to the audience, which I think might be that might point to some like the possibility of a fundamental problem there. So that's one thing. The second thing has already been mentioned, so I'll be very brief. We heard a lot of good examples today about innovation. There's a lot of smart people out there in the news agencies thinking about, working about what they can sell, how they can add value, and so on. And just a brief reminder again that the resources to do innovation are unequally distributed among these sort of national news agencies, of course. And again, if you make reference to the public, the audience, that they need this kind of quality verified information, then surely it's like all audiences, be they in the UK or in Estonia or in Serbia. And we just heard a very striking example during the afternoon from the head of the Serbian news agency, Tanjug. So they have an archive of like millions of images that are still like photos, negatives, that is a very highly monetizable resource. If you could sort of digitize this and make it into a photo archive, that is probably something that you could offer that would have value to clients. But they don't have the manpower and resources right now to digitize it. So here's like, if they're like, in a way, they're sitting on a pile of money that they can't use. That's also something to bear in mind in this, I think. So like organizational culture and sort of the differences that actually exist between these otherwise similar organizations. Thank you.
When I saw this question, who owns the news, I was a bit puzzled, what does it mean exactly? And I thought, well, you don't want to own something which has no value. And so do the news still have a value? We have nowadays a lot of people who think they don't have a value because it's free. You can go on the internet and you access the news, so they must be free, so they don't really have a value, so nobody owns them. It's a kind of vicious circle. And I remember, I'll just tell you a little story, I hope, which will make you understand better the situation of the media nowadays. I was in Strasbourg recently at the European Parliament, and we were speaking with a British MP about this specific subject, who owns the news. So he was telling us, but there's a blast in Baghdad. You don't own the blast in Baghdad, You can't tell me you own the blast, because there may be some guy there, he's got a smartphone, he's going to do pictures, he's going to do a video, and this is what we're going to see on TV. So after all, maybe he's the owner of this news. And I think that most people nowadays may think this way. Now, if we go back to the basics of how we work in an international or national news agency, I mean, what do we do with a blast in Baghdad first? I mean, how can it make its way to the headlines today or tomorrow? Well, first we look at the toll, how many people died, how many people were injured. In order to do this, we have to call hospitals, we have to call ambulance services, etc., etc. Then we wonder, is it an attack? Is it an accident? Is it a gas explosion? Is it a terrorist attack? And we have to look for sources to explain to us how it happened. Is it a car bomb, etc.? What was it done with? In order to do all this, you need journalists, you need professional journalists. Then, of course, you have to understand who did it. And again, you have to talk with sources. You are reconstructing the puzzle of what really happened. This is fact-checking. This is verifying the news. And in order to do this, at the end of the day, for a blast in Baghdad, you may have mobilized 15 people in the office, on the site, because are your photographers, your videographers, or your people doing video for TV images, they have to go there. Very often, it's at the expense, I mean, it can be at the expense of their lives. I mean, it happened to us in Kabul. Just a few months ago, there was an attack, there was a bomb, and then our photographers went, and our chief photographer in Kabul was killed, because quite often they do a second attack after the first one. So in order to collect all these news, you need people, you need techniques, you need people to be trained into doing this, and you need to pay them. So what I'm trying to make, the point I'm trying to make, is that this has a cost. So if it has a cost, it has a value. So if it has a value, there's an owner. There's a copyright owner of the news. And in nowadays world, it's a complicated question. And people have to answer that. Otherwise, we will see more and more media outlets disappearing all over this planet. And I'm afraid that if they disappear, then disinformation will proliferate. And this is something we really have to think about.
Hello, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Madhav, and I need to first declare a personal interest that I actually started in news at a news agency. I was one of the people who helped found Associated Press Television back in 1994, and I worked my way up through AP, even had some amazing time in the newsroom. I was acting Asian editor for a while, until I fell out with the international editor and I got shoved into the business side of the business. And then I was at the BBC, and one of my roles at the BBC was actually negotiating with news agencies. So I have a very strong personal interest and affection for news agencies, and that's actually why I came here, because originally I think it was going to be talking about the future of the news agencies. And I apologize for not being here this afternoon. I planned to be here this afternoon. And then my boss came into town, and that just blew up my diary for the whole day. But I think everything that has been said is absolutely spot on. I think news agencies are incredibly important. I wrote down the word that Terry said, that they are concealed, and that's some of the issues. And then you've got the B2B versus B2C and the innovation side of it. Everything that Christine said is totally true. You know, I think that the cost of news agencies, and when I was at the AP, we had at least three people lose their lives there, two of whom I knew quite well. And you know, this is a really deep and important stuff that is also very, very difficult. And I think when I look at what I'm trying to do now, I work at Google, which is obviously a technology company, but I work on the news side of that with what Google does with the news industry overall. And I think, you know, if I'm trying to blend the news agency piece with the title of the Who Owns the News, I think the one thing that's changed in all the time that I've worked in news is actually the power balance around news. That, you know, when I started at APTV, actually when there was that when there was that blast in Baghdad, the only way that somebody found out about it was through a news agency and through a news outlet, right? That was the only way. And I think that what happened is that the internet fundamentally disrupted that power balance. And you know, some people have called news agencies and news organizations kind of gatekeepers to the news. But I think the thing that shifted in the power balance is that it went to the user, right? You know, you were talking about audiences there. I think that's been an incredible challenge. And I think it's something that is actually, we need to diagnose properly if we're going to put in place sustainable solutions for this. Because I think everyone has the same goal in mind, which is how do we get to a sustainable news ecosystem that includes news agencies and includes, you know, citizen journalists or whatever we call them now, right? In a way that's healthy. And these are deep and important issues. And I think, don't want to pitch anything that Google is doing, but I think we are trying to do things. We have been doing things for a number of years. We had an initiative called DNI, the Digital News Initiative, which was working on product training and research and innovation, which is, I think, a good point. Happy to talk about that if we want to. We've actually gone global with that now, with the Google News Initiative. And all the things that we're doing are trying to work in collaboration with news organizations and news agencies to actually work on what are the sustainable things, because I only read some of the conclusions of the reports, but I think what I took away from that is there's no magic bullet that solves all these problems. And there's actually so many different types of situations where there are different types of news agencies that there are going to be multiple solutions and multiple things. And the only thing I think I've learned at a technology company is that we need to be trying things, and some of those things will, by the nature of trying, fail. But you actually need to be trying the things to see what are the ones that will work for you as an individual news organization or startup or news agency. And I think that's kind of the message that I wanted to get out, which is I think that this is very, very difficult, that we all need to work together and collaborate to try and work on a number of solutions, and some of them hopefully will work towards sustainability. So we talked beforehand, but I think it'd be more interesting to have a nice discussion, so I think I'll shut up at this point and hear from the learned panel and the audience. Thank you.
Just about sustainability, I think that it's complicated to be sustainable when the bulk of the online revenues are not going to content producers but to the platform. And this is the situation we are in at the moment. And I think that I know Google has done a lot of efforts to help us in developing innovation within the newsroom, and that was really important. But there's also, I think, now a big question mark about the sharing of the online revenues between the platforms and the media. Because even if you try to adapt, and I would take the example of BuzzFeed, for example, I mean, they are getting young audiences, they have the right language. You could think that they're going to succeed, and, just last week they announced massive layoffs. So I think that there's this online revenue, advertisement revenue problem that will have to be solved both sides of the Atlantic, and I hope we can do it together.
I think you're absolutely right. The revenue issue is for me, and the business model side of it is important. And I think it's important to kind of diagnose this. And I must confess, I worked at AP and the BBC before I came to Google, so I'm not an ads expert. So I have to go and understand and try to learn the ads business. And I think you're absolutely right. The ads business that news publishers are in, like, for example, BuzzFeed, who, by the way, made $300 million a year, so they're doing okay, right? I think there's a lot of news organizations that would like $300 million as a revenue line.
It's true, but
yeah.
It's not so good anymore.
And that's because of the business elements of it. Again, what you're talking about is there's a cost and revenue side of it. But I think, again, when you look at the online revenue, news organizations, they do digital display advertising, right? And that is a part of the market that is a part of the market where Google is a supplier, right? And in that market, we only make money when publishers make money, right? And we do a revenue share where the vast majority, 70% plus, goes to news organizations, right? And so again, we are working and our incentives are aligned in that case to grow the digital display market because, we're a supplier in there. So I completely agree with you.
I thought you had it was a very good explanation about how sort of news costs money. Like, in order to find out about this like blast, you know, you need to like maybe have 15 people active for like a day in order to like produce something, and which is absolutely true. But I think that the problem is, of course, that this is true, but people don't care.
I'm gonna try to explain this
because I'm of course like not, you know, I also think that this is important and we should pay for it. But it, news was always a good where there's very little possibility for the consumer to like judge the quality. Because you don't know if it was 15 people or one. You don't know if, like, who checked and who didn't and when and what. It's like a non-transparent good in that sense. Like you don't know. You just sort of have to trust the brand. And I also think like I've also thought about this for a long time. And like I meet students and I meet like people and. People have very little idea about what journalists actually do all day. That's my experience, and even less so about what people in news agencies do all day. So I think, like, just, of course, we need verified news, but you have to, like, tell or make visible to the audience that this is something that has value, which is something that not only news agencies, but news in general has not been very good at doing. They have in fact historically been trying to sort of like almost hide how they work from the general public. So that's what I mean. I mean,
sorry, please. No, I was gonna say I completely agree with you. I think that, am I allowed to bring up the Reuters Institute? Too much competitors, but you know, Reuters did an interesting piece of research where they were looking at whether, you know, attitudes to paying for news, and they actually asked a lot of people, and most people thought that most news organizations were making lots of money.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. They didn't actually realize that.
Yeah.
And I think that transparency element will help people understand that value, yeah. Right? Because they don't have it yet. And you know, one of the things that I thought was really inspiring in terms of trying to explain. And be more transparent about that is the Globe and Mail in Canada last year did something around World Press Freedom Day called World News Day, where they created an event to really celebrate all the power of news, and they brought people who were affected by news, the journalists, they also brought celebrities, and I thought it was a really interesting thing that they did, which is, you know, right now the kind of narrative on news is so negative, it's fake news and this and that, but actually, news is amazing. Right? And news has that value and has that power. And I think as an industry, we should be better about showcasing that story so that people can see that value. And I think there's a lot around transparency. And if anybody wants to know more about World News Day, the Globe and Mail are trying to make it actually a World News Day. So if you want to know more, find me afterwards, because I think it's a really cool idea. And if people got together and did things, I think it'd be very cool. Sorry.
Yeah, I fully agree with you both. And we are trying to do something in this direction. And this is with Facebook. They've been under attack, as you know, because of carrying fake news, disinformation, etc. So they signed up a contract. It's like they are like a client, basically, with us. And they asked us to debunk fake news. Now it's in 16 countries, and soon to be 20 countries. And on an everyday basis, we have something like 40 journalists around the world working, can be in Cameroon, it can be in South Africa, it can be in Poland, in Spain, in Canada, etc. Looking, you know, surfing the web to see fake news, I mean to debunk fake news, using our technologies, because we developed technologies, thanks to you, by the way, thanks to DNI, to really track the made-up photos, the made-up videos, and we can manage to do this. And then we label fake this news or that news. And I think that This way, maybe our role is more visible, saying what is fake than saying what is true. Unfortunately, this is the current situation. But I think you're right in saying that we have to make visible what it means verifying news, and especially in nowadays world where you can have politicians' websites or online information which is completely blurring what is true from what is not true, and so we should be visible into doing this.
I hope you use the fact check schema so that you can actually do that.
Yes, I would like to take Christine's point there because I think it's a very good example of how a news agency still has a brand that is kind of trustworthy. So they asked you because they thought that you would be able to check
yes,
the facts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But of course that cannot be taken for granted. So in the past, when almost every country had its own news agency and it had the name of the nation and the name of the technology and the name of the client, it was almost kind of official. So this agency tells us something. But that, I think, that brand, I think, needs to be kind of renewed in some way. And I think it's a very fine line because on the one hand, news agencies so much rely on it that there has always been this national agency in a country. And everybody knows, AFP in that country, for example. But there was this point, and maybe this is where Google comes in, when news agencies started losing their brand in a way. They became to be seen outdated and old-fashioned, and a news coming from somewhere else was faster and more exciting and was more kind of from below rather than from above. And I think media scholars, we are here to be blamed, and media students, we always embraced the latest technology. We thought that this was fantastic, that news was much more democratic, everybody could collect news, everybody could be a news seller or news blogger. But here we are, and I think, I hope you don't see this as a conservative step, but I think we are now talking about organizations, and when we were so thrilled by this latest technology, we actually forgot that there are these organizations who have been doing this kind of work for centuries, and they are there. They sometimes need a bit of a kick, but, basically, they are the organizations who know how to provide trustworthy news. So in a way, I think it's a really interesting situation where we are. I'm not saying that, for example, national news agencies should be saved at any cost in any country. If they are not doing what they should do, I'm not sure they are worth saving. But I'm not also sure whether it's a good idea to have Google UK, Google Finland, Google France, and Google something else instead. So in a way, there is something about national news agency that has to do with identity and citizenship and people having their news in their own language.
Can I just respond to that, and also to your point, and this is maybe an abstract point, but you started off, Christine, by saying news has no value because it's free.
Some people think news has
value. No, some
in
because it's free.
Work, yes.
Right. And then, but then we also have this conversation about how news has clearly a value in a stake in, let's say, democracy or informing citizens and that kind of thing. And then there's this idea of business models and branding. And I wonder if it's even possible. I mean, I think you were right that there's not a single magic bullet solution to this, but there are many different ways to kind of tackle this idea of value. I mean, we're all of you have talked about value in some way, and it makes me kind of go back to just a very basic kind of use value versus exchange value. And to think about what is, the use value of news at this moment, and how do we think about it in a new way? And I was absolutely stunned in some ways, I know I shouldn't have been probably, but by the layoffs at BuzzFeed and HuffPost and many other organizations last week. And in the United States, BuzzFeed got rid of their entire national news desk, the entire thing, right? And so clearly, that is about advertising. It's about a $300 million company, or whether or not that means a lot in this context or not. They clearly made a decision about what had value in terms of the information that they were disseminating to the public, and it wasn't national news. And so that, I mean, again, this is just a kind of a comment on all of, on what all of you said, that it is true that it has value. It's that I don't think that it has the same value for the different constituencies, and so there's a constant, you know, disconnect between what it is for, what we should use information for.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of these challenges, right? I think just to go back to your point about the brand, when I was at AP, we just had this big struggle about what kind of brand did AP have, because it was very much, as Henrik was saying, it was B2B, mm-hmm. right? And yet, the end user, as it were, in the end, never understood when they saw something that came from AP.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm on the television side, we used to have, you know, we dabbled with, well, maybe there should be a little watermark, and my God, the clients freaked out, because they didn't want to tell the public, you know,
sure.
And I'm sure you have this, where there's a lot of people online, when they tell you one of your clients, they don't want to put them, you know, they'll put the AFP thing as small down at the bottom as they can. And the only thing I wanted to add on that is, I think it's a challenge. One of the executives at the time came up with an analogy, and he said, how do we become like Intel, right? Because nobody buys, no human buys Intel, right? But they advertise, you hear there's the image, and you know there's a computer that has Intel in it. You know, is there a news site that has AP, and is there an equivalent? I don't know where to go with that, but I thought it was an interesting analogy.
Yeah, but for example, AP research
that
is that there was a study explaining that AP is the most looked at media organization online in the US. Of course, in France, AFP is, but in Britain, it's probably PA, and in Germany, DPA, because they are the source of news in terms of the television images. We have figures. I mean, they say basically that every year, AFP television images are shown 4 million times on the screens, I mean, by televisions every year. So it means that we are measuring each time a television in the world is showing an AFP image, it's a hit. So we have 4 million hits a year. So we are very present, and still we have a lot of problems monetizing all this, online especially. And as the traditional media are declining, and they are investing online, we are in search of this business model online. And you're not going to like it, because it's people do usually, especially in liberal countries, they don't like it. But when you have 75% of the online advertisement revenues going to the two big platforms, I mean, what do we need? Regulations? I think regulation is one answer. And this is what the media are asking for. Because at the end of the day, we all need, and you do, and we do, need a sustainable model.
I agree, and I think we need to actually be very precise about that. Because that 75% figure is actually not accurate in terms of what is relevant to news organizations.
Yes, yes,
right?
It's overall.
Right?
Right.
So, but that's mixing markets, right?
Right?
So again,
yeah,
we need to be very specific if we're going to diagnose this problem right. And I think you're right. And you know, one of the ideas that you know, that there's a question here, as you said, and I'm saying this on a personal basis. You know, is news a public good, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if one believes it's a public good, how does one deal with that, right? And you know, I heard an idea, and this was just in a bar, and don't attribute it to me because it wasn't my idea. But you know, when you look in the United, you know, in the UK, my previous employer, the BBC, has a license fee. You know. Why doesn't part of the license fee go towards the press association? You know, why doesn't the you know what?
Want it.
Yeah. I'm just it was like I said, Clyde, it wasn't my idea. It was somebody who put it up. And by the way, actually,
it was in a bar.
They were actually talking about AFP.
Why doesn't Google maybe gives some money to the Press Association, that would be far more sensible.
Well, we actually do, but we do it in a way that tries to simulate innovation rather than a dependency. By the way, to be clear, the person who said this idea was about AFP, but I saw Clive is here, so I didn't throw it in.
Thank you.
Well, why don't we open it up to Clive?
So, you say that there are multiple solutions. I think the solution is really, really simple. There needs to be a revenue model. We are wholesalers of content. I think we've heard some interesting ideas about the consumer marketplace, but in the main, news agencies provide the building block for news. Thank you. In the main, news agencies provide the building block for media owners to deliver their content. And most people want partisan content. They want content that reflects their view, their insights into the way that they see the world. But it's a very, very simple model. If I go onto Google, I can buy all sorts of products and services. And yet, you do not give people the opportunity to buy content. And content is not just about text, it's about imagery and it's about video. Now, under extreme pressure from Getty, you finally made an arrangement with Getty where money flows from Google to Getty, and although the information about the detail of that was confidential, clearly Getty are very happy with the outcome, and presumably you're happy as well. When I met with Margaret Vestager, the EU commissioner, I stressed to her how Google could be a force for good. You could set up digital right management systems that allowed those people that wish to buy imagery off your platform in the same way that I can buy a Google Nest product off one of your platforms. Mm-hmm. You don't do that. You link and you snip it and you take content from a myriad of different sources. If you're a clippings agency, you would pay a license, a copyright fee for that. You don't do that. What the solution that most people in this room that own news agencies need is a revenue stream, and you could very, very easily give that, and it would have minimal impact on the financial outcomes for Google. And yet, you lobby, and you work, and you strive to ensure that the status quo remains, and only under the most extreme pressure do we see change.
You're not going to be surprised to say that I had to take a different view. And but very soon, you know, we've had this conversation. I think it is a very important conversation. So I think it is really important to understand the different roles that different technology companies play if we are going to diagnose this properly. Okay? And the business model element is incredibly important. Google makes the vast, vast majority of its money on search advertising. This is not a business that publishers are in. This is when you search for digital camera and you see an ad for digital camera. We do not monetize news. Google News has never monetized news. That is different from social networks. Insert the name of your favorite social network here. We're shutting ours down because we couldn't do it. Right? So that is very important, right? The things that we do is that we provide traffic to news organizations that they are 100% in control of that. There have been protocols on the internet forever. So when you say we take and we do this, those controls have been there from the beginning of the internet. If you do not want to be in Google search, you can easily come out. It is there. And so therefore, the controls with the publisher. I do think what you're talking about, though, in terms of, you know, are we doing enough to try to help people sell the content onwards is a very good question. And, you know, we've tried to do more in that space. We launched Subscribe with Google. We're trying to do much more on that. It's taken a lot longer than that, but I think that's a very fair comment that we should be doing more in that space. I mean, for example, if you look at images, there are filters to figure out the license rates for images and stuff like that. So there's more that we are doing in that space, but please, if you're going to put a solution, diagnose the problem and how things work first. Because if you want a revenue share on the money that Google makes off news, it'll be pretty much zero because we don't monetize news. The things that we're doing in news is trying to send traffic, which, again, to be clear, that has a value, right? That does have a commercial value as well, which is why everybody works with SEO and complains when they don't get to the top of the rankings, because they know that search delivers value to them. So when we put solutions in place here, we need to understand the overall value exchange. But I do agree with you, and that's why we're trying to do things under DNI and GNI, that more needs to be done, okay?
My name is Alison Holmer. I'm from Exeter, University of Exeter. I'm working on DRM, markup languages. I'm looking at fingerprinting, watermarking, in the context of standards and interoperability between standards. And I think what we're talking about, all of us here, is Article 11 and 13 of the Copyright Directive without talking about it directly. And I was just wondering maybe if we could bring the conversation directly to that, because what the Commission is asking Google and others to do is to provide technical solutions to find these sorts of this sort of content and then take it down automatically. And maybe we could talk a little bit more about technical solutions to content DRM and how the market might be modeled around or not modeled around that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in terms of Article 13, you know, that's about YouTube and about, you know, video. We actually have those systems. We have a system called Content ID, which we spent multiple millions on that, right? So, you know, we have that system. I think the debate that you see, which actually goes beyond YouTube, is what are the requirements that you're putting on across the overall internet? And are you putting things in place with primary liability that will quash innovation and startups and creativity, right? And what's the right balance? And again, on the copyright stuff, we completely agree with the copyright law. They need to be updated for the 21st century. But again, they need to be balanced, so you're balancing the rights in the appropriate way. And you're doing this in a way. So, you know, we need the help from, you know, Content ID works because rights organizations say, here you go, this is ours, therefore we can get a digital footprint, therefore we can do that. You know, when I was at the BBC, we were one of the first people to use Content ID. And it was really interesting because at that point you had three options with Content ID. For your content, you could either block it from going up at all, you could measure it, or you could monetize it. So we were the BBC, we were conservative, we took the middle road. We said, let's just measure it and see what was there. And what we found that was really interesting was that the people that were putting up BBC News content were actually passionate BBC News fans. And they were actually doing our job for us, because they said actually more people need to know about that. And what you see now through Content ID is that the vast majority of rights holders actually monetize the content, because the people who are putting up the content are the fans and doing the work for them. So if you get the balance right, you get systems where everything, you know, it works for everybody. Rights holders are getting paid, you know, the fans are doing what they love, and users are getting access to content. So again, you know, I think technical solutions can help in that way. We need to get laws that reflect the right balance to make sure that it is a balanced approach. And that's why I think there's been a particular, you know, scream from the creators community that this main, you know, 13 and the details of that are not balanced in the right way.
No, just to maybe some of the students, you don't know about this copyright directive. I don't know if everybody is aware of what it means. No? Basically, it was based on the observation that because 3/4 of the online revenues are going to two platforms, and I know it's not only news, but news is part of it, and news is a driving force for the people to go onto the platforms. So this observation that all this revenue was going to two platforms and the rest was the small part was going to other actors, media being a small part of them, it was just unsustainable, completely imbalanced, and it had to be corrected. So that's what the Commission has been trying to do for 2 years now. So they put this directive on the table 2 years ago. It's been discussed by Parliament. It's been it has gone back to the Council recently, and there's a lot of fighting around it with Google. It doesn't completely agree with the terms of it, but at the end of the day, what it would basically say is that, well, if PA is consulting that number of time, if DPA is consulted that number of time on Google, and same for AFP and other media organization, they need to get a share of these online revenues, and therefore Google will have to give some money to them. And that can be a way of partnering and finding a sustainable solution. But the situation we are in at the moment, I don't see a lot of other solutions. There has to be some rebalancing of the economic model.
Forgive me, but that's actually not what the law says. Right.
Yeah,
the law says is that search engines and social networks and anything on the internet needs to take a license to show a link and a snippet. That's 11.
Yeah.
Right? To show a link and a snippet. Whereas right now, that's the power there. The power with the publisher has always been there. I think the challenge, and this is why you've seen small publishers, why you've seen civil society and academics push back against 11 in particular, is that it's genuinely not practical for any company to license everybody on the web. That's not how the web works. And therefore, you're going to... No, because again, the publishers have power already. And
no, not so much. Otherwise, I wouldn't be dying.
but that goes back to the first question we talked about, which is actually came from the audience side, right?
Even the ones who are the most developed for the young audiences, and even those ones...
If BuzzFeed went out of business, I would agree with you. BuzzFeed has a $300 million revenue stream per year. The reason they have layoffs is because they're trying to figure out what is the right size of the business, right? What is the right size? And I think that's the difficult question for organizations in the 21st century. What's the right size of the news organization for the 21st century?
Let's have a question from the student.
My name is Abir. I do master in media. I study master in media at LSE. And my question for Mardan Chinapa. I travel very frequently between the UK and the Middle East, different countries in the Middle East. And I'm interested in news every time, although I search with the same exact words, the news comes out absolutely different from here and in different countries in the Middle East. So my question is about the geoblocking system. How does that affect news consumption, not only in the UK, but worldwide? Thank you.
So I just want to make sure I understood. So you're doing a search on google.com for Trump, and you see different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we try to just, and again, I should have said in my personal statement, I'm like the least technical person at Google. I'm just a news guy, right? We try to use a number of factors to try to see what's relevant to you, right? So, again, we're trying to, and we use a very few signals to try and discern that. And one of them, if you've opted in and allow us to know where the location is, we'll try and do that, because we'll try and surface to you the things that we think will be relevant for you in the UK. I travel, if you're in the UK versus if you're in the Middle East. I travel a lot too, and again, I find it quite irritating actually, because it's like stop that, please. I do that, right? So, but again, you got to think about the scale of what Google's trying to do. One of the complexities about Google is just the type of scale, that the vast majority of people don't travel as much as we do. So we're trying to do things for everybody, and so it ends up we can make a product that's great for the vast majority of people. There will be a certain subset that this doesn't fit as perfectly as possible. But again, there are certain things that you can do. You can go into My Account, so when you go into Google and you see that little picture of you, whatever, you can go in and try and personalize some of your own settings as well.
Thank you.
There's one right in the middle and then in the back. The right. Sorry. And then.
I'm trying to play a devil's advocate here and go back to actually Henrik's first point, which is, do they care? And what does the end consumer think? So my kind of question would be that isn't this just a very, very simple situation which doesn't differ from any other business that is in the constant kind of a situation of major oversupply because of the structural changes that internet has caused? And the great service Google and Facebook is giving to people so that they can find the best pieces of content and consume them and leave the 99% of content unused. In other words, is the world going to a worse direction or better direction, and is the problem of the business everybody's problem, or is it just the problem of getting used to the new situation?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, the digital environment and everything it's of course like everybody's problem or issue or whatever, because it's changing more businesses than just it's changing retail, it's changing medicine, how we get treated by the doctor, because now you can see the doctor on a, like on a, you know, on an online link and so on. So this, it's clearly disruptive for a lot of audiences, or for a lot of people, for a lot of industries, yeah. And sure, and you know, if you, I'm sure that you know that everybody here at the LSE know about Kondratiev and Schumpeter. That these are just the kind of things that like happen sometimes. Like, you know, maybe, you know, we don't have mechanical calculators anymore. Yeah, that was a business. That business is gone. It died. Yeah, so. Like, there, you know, there will probably be like news in some form, but not in the sort of, maybe not in the form that we recognize it. And just to that point, to clarify, when I was talking about the audience and like this, the business to business, I wasn't suggesting that news agencies should start selling stuff to like customers, to news to customers. That wasn't what I meant. But what I meant was that it's of course an inherent problem if your business model is built on top of someone else's business model. Yeah? That's the news. If you are the people who provide like legacy news organizations with news, that sort of idea presupposes that there are legacy media organizations that can buy them. Yeah? And they then in turn are sort of interested in or transmitted to the end user. So, like, it's like a general transformative force, whether it's for good or ill, I guess we'll know in 200 years. Can't say. But that sort of, that specific problem of, like, what you build your business model on top of, that's like a sort of more specific news agency problem, I think. I don't know if that answers your question.
Partly.
I'll think a bit more about it.
Sarah Tianatman, I'm a research assistant on one of the case studies on business model innovation. I would like to ask Mr. Chinappa, you thought that Google doesn't monetize news. I couldn't understand how you define monetized news. I mean, do you think that monetizing news is just selling news subscription or paywall?
No, I was referring to the vast majority of Google's business as search advertising, where when you put in a term, you will see ads on the right-hand side of the search results from the top, depending on mobile or laptop. And that's how Google makes its money. And those are all based on the keywords that people want to buy against.
So my point is that, I mean, people search on Google for a content, for a published content. It is whether news or other content that I think Google doesn't produce.
Yeah, and we don't show ads against that, because that's what we're doing there is we're trying to send traffic to the publisher.
Why do you often use that?
Because we think it's important for society to be able to access news, you know, as part of our mission. And it's a very good question, because there's a lot of, I'm not sure how many people know why Google News was created. Right? So Google News was created actually by one Indian software engineer in his 20% time, because he happened to be on 9/11, he happened to be in New Orleans. And his flight to California was obviously canceled, so he came back, he turned on the TV, he was in kind of a loop of horror, and he wanted to try to find out what was going on. And he tried to go, and this is, you know, this is 2001, so he was trying to go from site to site, because he wanted to find out what was going on, and he wanted to see different points of view, and he found it incredibly difficult. So he built Google News in his 20% time, which is that time they magically give to engineers, one day a week they can do whatever they want. I hope to be an engineer in my next life. But he built that solely to try to connect users and publishers. And that's all that we're trying to do.
But there are lots of products that are built in 20% time, like the News Reader or Google Reader you had, which got discontinued because it wasn't profitable. So you only keep products going that are profitable.
That's not true. We do a lot of products that don't make any money.
But is that not because you have a whole platform that, you know, you offer Google Maps for free because it brings people to Google?
Actually, we monetize maps. So there are things that we monetize and things that we don't. So, you know. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm getting your point.
That you offer services for free because it draws people to your platform generally.
Generally, yeah. Yeah, and we think that the value that we give, going back to value, is good enough for that, and that if people don't like it, they've got complete control over it as well.
Sorry about that.
It's all right, Clive. Don't
I don't mean sent to stalk you, but if you think about the
world... Sorry, we can do it in the drinks too.
Go for it. If you think about the world we live in today, where more and more people want short snippets of information, I've just had a quick look at the one of the Google services. I can get all of the latest headlines. I don't need to click on any story, go to any publisher's site, because there's enough in the headline. I can tell you what the stock market price was when it ended today. I can tell you that the Dubai ruler has just got planning permission for his house in the Highlands. I can tell you that Blackstone's in war with an Italian tycoon. I'm not clicking on anything, but you're keeping me inside your ecosystem, so you're getting economic value. There is no economic value going to the creators of that content. And often that will be a news agency, but it can also be a publisher. And I know that they can go back and they can change the software and stop the content coming through, but that's not how the world works today. So I think we're being a little bit disingenuous with the defense.
Forgive me, I don't think you're seeing the whole picture, because what people do on Google and what news is, it is literally a go-away site, right? And billions upon billions of clicks, which have direct revenue, and you can look at all the data, and Deloitte did a report about, you know, what is the value of a click, okay? That is actual direct revenue when a click from Google, which is multiple billions. I think it was last time we did the numbers, officially I think it was 12 billion, I can't remember, but it's actually higher than that. We're gonna release some new numbers at some point. But those clicks have value directly to a publisher. And the evidence that they have value to a publisher, if you don't even believe all the Deloitte stuff, go and talk to any news publisher about what they think about in terms of search, in terms of driving traffic, right? That has a value to them.
So why do they all support Article 11?
They don't all support Article 11.
Yes, they do.
The large publishers support Article 11. The small and medium publishers do not.
Wow.
Please go and look at ANSA, the Small and Medium Publishers Association in Italy, AAPP, the Small and Medium Publishers.
Can you speak with them on an everyday basis? recently, we signed a letter together last week, not so long as last week. And all the big media organizations, yeah, but we are talking about the media everybody are watching, are reading. So all these are supporting Article 11 because they think they can't live in this environment anymore. They need more balance in the revenues than there is right now.
So everyone is trying to characterize this copyright fight as kind of publishers versus Google.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that media can't live in an environment where, I mean, the audiences you were talking about, they are online. We all know that. The paper doesn't sell anymore. I mean, most media have made a lot of investment to exist online. Problem is that they invest a lot of money because paper doesn't sell anymore, but they don't get revenues or very little revenues, and we've even seen in some countries, including France, including Spain, Southern Europe is even more affected than Germany, for instance. They even saw their online revenue declining, when the audiences are booming. So audience doesn't mean revenue anymore. So how do you make your living?
Yeah, and the point I was trying to make is that you said all publishers believe in this. And
yes,
the only point all the big publishers
unions are believing in this.
But you've completely discounted all the small and medium publishers that exist that
no.
understand the value of the ecosystem
no.
and are trying to come up with a different balance.
Okay,
well, by the way, there'll be a blog post tomorrow where you'll be able to see a series of links that are completely independent of Google about people on this. It's not a Google versus publishers thing. This is about what's the right thing for the ecosystem. But I agree with you.
The specialized press is for it. The magazine press is for it. The daily press is for it. I mean, I could mention all the organizations if you want.
I could too, but I don't think it'd be very much fun for the audience.
Let's take this question.
So, first off, I mean, national news agencies are actually doing worse than my favourite football team at the time, so it's terrible. But I think we don't have to worry, Mada. We can all be calm in here, because the payoff of Google is do no evil. So you're going to sort this out yourself, right? Or not.
Do you want me to answer that?
No, not right now. What I would like to stress is that there has been regulation in the past in a number of different European countries where you have been forced to pay publishers. But instead of paying the publishers, you go back to the publishers and you say, you just don't have to use our platform. Don't be on our platform if you don't like it. And that's the prerogative. That's what you can do when you're a monopolist. We used to be monopolists as well before, and we'd love to go back to be monopolists. Everyone wants to be Alphabet or Google. I mean, that would be absolutely great. Do no evil, eh? But my question is if legislation now will happen, when Margrethe Vestager, who seems to be a bit concerned about what is going on with the news industry in Europe, will you comply?
So it might surprise all. Sorry, go
ahead. It just sort of occurred to me that what's happened historically here, and to the point that, like you, Clive, you talked about, like this is the world we live in now, and you said that news agencies used to be monopolists. Well, news agencies were invisible because, like 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, they were more than a company, they were an infrastructure, right? News agencies were an infrastructure. It was actually news agencies invented many of the processes by which content was transferred between media organizations. Yeah, that was, so news agencies were the infrastructure. Now they're not the infrastructure anymore. Google is the infrastructure. Google is not just a company, which is that, then this is like an important point. That you can, it's very hard to opt out of an infrastructure. That's just a, like it was hard for people to opt out from like news agencies. You get your news from us or you don't get them, but you're welcome.
But the infrastructure is not Google. The internet is the infrastructure. Google could cease to exist and all of the current situation would be exactly the same.
But you drive all the trains on the tracks.
I think Mark Zuckerberg might disagree with you.
Not when it comes to search.
But isn't that the opportunity to answer your question?
Yeah. Please answer my question.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, it might surprise the audience. Jonas and I are actually good friends, right? and fellow Liverpool supporters. So it's been a tough couple of days for us. So let's be specific about what you said. You're talking about Germany.
Yes.
Okay. So they passed an ancillary copyright law in Germany where that was targeted at news aggregators. So in Google News, what we said is you have, like I said before, you as a publisher have always had the right to allow your content to be indexed in Google News. Please, can you confirm your consent in this? And the vast majority of publishers did because it was valuable to them, right? They understood the trade-off that the discoverability of being in Google News was worth it, and that's why they did it. The tiny percent that didn't do it, they exercised their right and judged that it wasn't worth the trade-off. And so they weren't in Google News. That's what they did. They exercised their right, and that's what we think people should do.
I think Terry wanted to respond in the last question.
No, just a comment on this discussion. I find it very interesting that we mostly talk about Google.
Facebook isn't here.
To be clear, there were a bunch of people who said, why are you going to this? And I said, it's because it's important and I love news agencies.
Yes, so let me finish, please. We have like 40... CEOs of European news agencies here, and what I hear them saying, oh, you Google, you do this and that, instead of them talking about what they do and why is it important to talk about news agencies instead of Google. So why does it always have to be Google nowadays? Why don't we talk about this very interesting news organizations that have been operated since the 19th century, do we all feel that, you know, they are not as interesting as Google?
No, because information has a cost.
Yeah,
if it has a cost,
we
have to have revenues.
We produce the news, but Google and Facebook own the news. So this is the answer.
But I think, again, I would strongly recommend you think about the roles that Google and Facebook play. They're two very, very different companies. And actually, you let both companies off the hook when you conflate them and talk about the duopoly. They do very, very different things with different business models and different values. If you want to go back to Christine's point about, you know, the share of revenue, if you look at the display advertising business, that's actually when Google is with publishers as a supplier competing against Facebook, right? If you have a pound, a dollar, or a euro, and you want to put that into display, you could go to Facebook and put it there, or you could go to a publisher, right? And if Google powered some of the technology, then Google would get a rev share there. That is direct competition. Again, these companies have, and you can add Apple and Amazon and all the other ones, they try to conflate together, but these tech companies have different things that they do, and we need to be really, really important to understand that if we're gonna figure out what is sustainable and appropriate.
Okay, we have time for just one more question, but then we do have a drinks reception immediately following right upstairs. I don't know if Martin's going to be there. He might be taking off that side door.
I think Jonas and Klein were buying me a drink. I think that's what I said.
So we can continue this very interesting discussion upstairs, but for now, one last question.
So this is a different question than Google, which I guess everyone's really happy about. It's just the point you mentioned about infrastructure. Do you see, and this is the whole panel, any parallels to the music industry? Because the music industry printed CDs and all of that, and then the internet came along and Napster basically threatened their business models, and then everyone had to reinvent what they were doing, and Spotify and the rest were born. So is anyone talking about new Spotify's or any other solutions that have come out of the music industry?
Well, I just want to mention that the news industry in France has a neighboring right, and they were saved by a neighboring right. So it could be a solution, because this is what we're talking about with Article 11.
You're going to have to explain that to me over drinks, because I didn't think you had a neighboring right.
Yeah, we do, for music.
Oh, for music, yeah, you music. Music,
this is,
oh, yeah,
this
music.
This is what we are talking about.
Music, yeah.
Yeah.
I think your question probably also takes us to the concept of news. What is, you know, we are talking about news and agencies, and both are kind of being renewed in many ways. And I think Atte mentioned news being a good. So, and we have been talking about whether it's a public good and whether, you know, is it a physical good as any other good, or does it have qualities that other goods do not have. So in a way we are talking about many different things here, but actually music industry was mentioned today, this morning, when we visited the Press Association, and our speaker was kind of making comparisons between music industry and news industry. So it's, I think you are on the right track.
Could I, this is a complete personal view. I get really worried when what I call a false analogy syndrome. Everyone talks about Spotify for news or iTunes for news or this for that. I think exactly to your point that you made earlier, which is that we need to understand what is that, what is the nature of news, right? You know, if I have an album that I like or a song that I like, I will listen to it multiple times. I challenge you to find a news article that you would listen to multiple, that you would read multiple times, right? I think we need to understand the differences that are there if we're going to come up with solutions that are appropriate. I'm not saying that it can't be done, and people do talk about it, but again, it goes back to that fundamental about, you know, what is that, what is the value that you're getting there?
Yeah, I mean, I still think there's some good similarities there. You know, books you don't read multiple times, but you might have a favorite author or favorite journalist.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think if you look at some of the stuff that's been done, some of the experiments that have been done, so if you look at Piano Media, they operated a kind of a country-level paywall in Slovakia, and they did that in Poland. The interesting thing was, you know, where, you know, what happened in Poland was that the kind of, the New York Times of Poland didn't think they were getting enough value from being in it. They pulled out, and the whole thing kind of collapsed on itself, and I think that's some of the challenges that you have when you get to the Spotify of news is, how do you make the pricing work, right? And everything that I've ever seen on it is that the big draws of the New York Times or whomever, they're the ones who actually want to, they bring people in, but they don't get the most value, so they're like, forget it, I'll just go get the subscriptions myself, right? So it becomes, you know, again, it's an interesting idea, and I'd love somebody to crack the model, but again, devil's in the detail, experimentation needed, you know, let's see.
I understand the Beatles went on Spotify pages.
Yeah.
Also, just the kind of disconnect between pricing and consumer models, and as Terry said, how we should be thinking about news as a public good, and what that means, both the public part of that and the good part of it. So in any case, this has been a very interesting conversation. Please join us for wine upstairs and continue it. Thank you very much to this panel.